So, Murshid has also given us these practices. They're called the purification breaths. They are to be done every day. Every day. And it's an inner ablution, you might say, of love and light and life. And so as we breathe in and we breathe out, we repeat the phrase silently and inwardly. I inhale divine light and life. And when breathing out, I radiate divine life and light. And again, for those that the practice is new, the first phrase is light, L-I-G-H-T, and life. And as we breathe out, then it changes to life, L-I-F-E, and light. And Murshid gives us the instructions to feel that we're drawing in with the breath through all of space, light and life. And he says, even love. And if we think about this, we're really expanding our awareness because we're drawing in that light and that life from all directions, all celestial bodies, you might say. Think of all of the planets and all of the universes upon universes. It's extraordinary what they're finding out with the Hubble telescope. And all of that light and that life teeming, we're participating with that. And we're breathing it in, and the vibration of love as well. So we start by breathing in the nose and out the nose. And when we inhale, I inhale divine light and life. And when we breathe out, we radiate that back, giving it back. I radiate divine life and light. And the breath should be full and in a rhythmic pattern. So let the breath come in. Take your full breath in to your full capacity without forcing it. And breathe out to your full capacity again without forcing it. In the nose and out the nose, concentrating on the phrase. Phrase remains the same, but the breath changes, and we breathe in the nose and out the mouth. In the nose and out the mouth. Keep in mind as we breathe, this is a purification breath, an inner ablution that allows the various channels be cleansed from the inside. We move the direction of the breath so that the breath can take its current in the various directions. So now in through the nose and out through the mouth, the direction is descending. breath moves in through the mouth and out through the nose. The breath is ascending in through the mouth and out through the nose. Continuing to repeat the phrase inwardly, I inhale divine light and life. I radiate divine life. In the mouth and out the mouth, in the mouth and out the mouth, breathing in and out, while inhaling, I inhale divine light and life, I radiate divine life. Directionless, moving in all directions like air. Dissolve. Feel your inner state, feel your body, feel the quality of breath. Notice the field of your mind. anything you'd like to share of your experience? Or any questions?
I can sense a light.
Light?
An inhalation through the mouth at the nose. There was an expansion. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know,
the sensations of light.
Light. Beautiful. Do you feel calmer and more restful also? This is important. Yes. When we're not grounded, then that's the embodiment of the master, the spirit, the embodiment of the master. That's what we're here to do, is embody the spirit. I mean, that's what we are. We're embodiments of spirit, really. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I have not thoughts, but feelings of being as close to being a tree as I could be,
mm-hmm.
and the understanding that with their being, they breathe in the poisons of the earth and
they
let out the air.
They do.
To keep us going, to keep us alive.
Yeah, it's beautiful, isn't it? I pray for those trees when I come home from the college on State Line, because they're so, they're the evergreens that have been planted to kind of shield the homes, but they're tortured and tormented with the emissions from the cars. You can see that the one side's all dark, and some of that might be from the rock and salt that's put on the, also that gets splashed on them, but you can see that they have their, they suffocate in that way. Yeah. That's what stress does. Stress is good for us. You know, it's the thing that gets us up and out of the way when we're in trouble, but chronic stress is very hard on our bodies. It leads to the diseases that we know of, cancer and heart disease and things like that. Chronic stress. This is why these practices are important. Even if it gives us just a few moments of release, it helps, I think, to relieve that stress. Do you not feel that? Really, they're vital for our well-being and balance. Thank you.
I was noticing for myself how it's interesting that at the same time there's the calming and the stilling effect and the grounding, as David mentioned too, but also I find that there's an enlivening in that. So it's interesting to experience that, because often, you know, maybe I tend to think of liveliness or being enlivened can get confused with excitation, maybe, you know, getting that energy built up in a way. But it's interesting to experience how alive I feel in that breath, which is very different than sometimes states that I get myself into when I'm at work, you know, too. And
yeah, that was one of the great lessons. But there's been many that I've gotten from Karunaji, and that was, I remember years ago, she said to me, "Noria, if you feel you're breaking bricks in life, you can be sure that you've lost your contact with the divine." She said, "When you are in contact with the divine, you are never getting tired." You know what I'm saying. I mean, of course you have to sleep, but you know that life is so... And she said, when you feel that way, you know you've lost your contact with the divine. You have to find that connection. So it's like you said. And I mean, the Buddha didn't sit under the, you know, the banyan tree, like, asleep. He was waking up. I mean, that's what it means to be the Buddha. It means the awakened one. It's not the sleepy, relaxed one. Do you know what I mean? So, is there someone there that has a question or comment? And please unmute so we can hear you.
Roger, go ahead and...
Raheem.
Raheem, I'm sorry. Go ahead and unmute. It's more of a statement than a question.
Okay.
Go ahead.
We can't hear him.
Thank you. Am I unmuted?
There you
You're
are.
You're unmuted. Hi.
I just wrote a comment, and it had to do with the evergreen tree. I thought it was really appropriate for today's lesson. I associate the tree with a clean, wonderful aroma. I wrote in soft needles and a breath of purity, and it just seemed to tie everything together. And I just love whomever mentioned the tree. It just really hit my heart, so thank you.
That's Marie Shafi.
You're more than welcome.
One of your sisters here. Can I go a little while longer with me?
Mm-hmm.
We'll probably stop at about 4, and then we can have some tea and some treats. Anyone else have any comments? Kathy, how about you? Patty.
Rashmi.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Patty. Patty.
Just listen out.
And bring it all the way through your feet, too. This is from supplementary papers, classes for Murids, class number 8. Again, these aren't published in a particular text, but they're the supplementary papers. This is on the subject of breath. The breath is what connects us with God, and the breath connects us also with manifestation. We are conscious that the breath reaches a certain distance without, and we are conscious that it enters into our bodies a certain distance. But we are not conscious how far without it goes, nor are we conscious how far it enters into our bodies. As long as the breath is in the body is alive. And when the breath has left the body becomes a useless thing. This shows us the importance of the breath. It reaches within to every part of the body. Now here, it's very, you know, I think we can read these things and we can so easily pass over. What does one think that it means? We are conscious that the breath reaches out a certain distance. And we are conscious that it enters a certain distance. We're not conscious how far without it goes, nor are we conscious how far it enters our bodies. That's a very big statement there. There's no aim that cannot be accomplished by the breath. And if we fail to accomplish our aims, it is because we have 1,000 different aims before us. Not one alone. It becomes very difficult in the world where attacks come from 1,000 sides. The breath goes out to meet an attack from one side. And instantly it has to turn to another side to face another attack. It would have to turn to every side in the same moment, and this it cannot do. This is the reason of failure, even of sages and saints and mystics. Understand. It's a lack of concentration. And you see, if you study things like, is it Zatsun's? Roger probably knows the Art of War.
Lao Tzu.
It was Lao Tzu, but at any rate, the whole idea is that if one is not here, present, solid, and one is going there to attack that thing and there to attack that thing, we are continually out of balance. Enough will come to us. We don't need to go out after it. Do you understand? This is what he's saying. So I'm saying this, it's really, people that are on bandwagons a lot would be good for them to hear this. Because you see, one has very little effect in the world if one's constantly, you know, raising this banner and then I'm going to do this and now I want to do that. And, you know, for a cause. It can be for something very good. But if one stays very concentrated in one area where one knows they can have an influence, then it's much better than doing so many different things. Does that make sense? It's like studying. You become a professional in one subject area. Now, some people may be extremely brilliant and they can do that in cross disciplines, but usually it's best to study one subject deeply. And to tell you the truth, people do that. They attack books. Oh, I'm going to read that book so quickly, and it's like an attack. Or I'm going to study this thing. I have to know, you know, it's like, really, if the energy is like that, I'm attacking something. I'm going to gobble it up. Does that make sense? We all know that. We've all done it. We understand. I have to conquer it, might be another way of saying it. Sufi looks at it as I master myself in doing so. It's different. Doesn't this make a little more sense? It's a very subtle, he taught in a very subtle way. I've been studying because I'm giving one of the keynote lectures at summer school. And the summer school subject is judgment and understanding. It's not an easy subject. Judgment and understanding. And so I was looking at Hazrat Light Khan's teachings, and one of his students asked him a question, something like, Murshid, can you explain to us God's justice and his judgment? And Hazrat Naik Khan said, oh, I'll explain it by the way of a simile, a little story. And he said something like, there is a man who is the father of two children, and they are fighting over their toys. And the one child says, I want that toy. That toy was given to me. I want to hold that toy. But the other child says, but we can, you know, why can't we play with these toys together? And so there's a struggle. Or one child might say, well, that toy is unappealing to me. Why was it given to me and not the other child? He's telling a story, but you can get the drift that this is a whole other thing he's talking about here, that we're this way in life. We're comparing things. Why did that person get that privilege and I didn't? I worked just as hard and I want to have this, and they have it. Somebody was nice to them and they weren't nice to me. I mean, it goes on and on. And he's telling them this in a very nice way about a little story about these children. Do you understand? Which at one level it can be seen that way. And in the other, it's, and then he says, and what the children, if the child comes to a certain point, the child will even accuse the father of being unjust. How many times do we do that? Where is God in this, we say? How does God let this happen? You understand? He's giving this beautiful little simple story, and you're thinking, oh my God, in a few words, it's like. And then he says, but the child has not yet risen to the level of understanding of the father, and therefore judges. And also he says the child might not know that the father gave that specific toy to that child because the father knew that it would develop something in their character by doing so. The child judges that. And then the lesson is lost. Woe is me. Why is this happening to me? Maybe there's a very good reason for it. The struggle is the blessing. The loss is the victory. The victory is sometimes the defeat. It can become a burden. Once we attain something, it can burden us. Someone wrote me this week who's doing stress-free workshops, and I thought, good luck. But at any rate, they asked a question, and they asked it of myself and a few other people. Some of you might have gotten the email because I copied some people into the email because I thought it was good. I thought it was a good question. I gave a bit of an answer different than perhaps they would have expected. But they had asked, in the work that some of us, the people that were directed, the mail, do with people that are underprivileged, I thought I didn't say this to the person, but I felt perhaps it was a projection of their own mind. But there is another answer as well. Why do you think that those people are more happy, perhaps, than we are in this modern world, in this modern society that have everything? And I will read you, because I keep that always with me. I love this one sutra from the Pali Canon of the Buddha that talks about the causal conditions of happiness. But part of it is, you know, just the simplicity also. I remember living in India, and, you know, when you're living in an 8-by-8-foot room and everything's in there, I mean, you're cooking, you're cleaning, you're living, you're praying, and you get real simple. For example, you need a knife, one really good knife that can do everything, right? This is an example. You don't need a whole lot of knives. We don't need a whole big butcher block thing full of all kinds of different knives. We don't need paring knife, and chopping knife, the eating knife. You need a knife. And that knife has got to do everything. But if I only have one knife, then I only have to find a place for just one knife. I only have to clean one knife. I only have to keep one knife sharpened. I only have to carry one knife. My life's a lot simpler. And the more we have, the more we have to take care of, the more we have to attend to. And that makes complexity. And that makes unhappiness, too. Because it makes stress and worry on us. Why have a whole thing full of shoes in your closet? It makes too many freaking choices. Should I wear that shoe or should I wear that shoe? Should I wear that? Oh, I have to have that shoe for that and that shoe for that outfit. It's like one freaking pair of shoes or a couple. You know, one closed, one open, one winter, one, you know, or a couple. But, you know, otherwise then there's too many shoes in the closet too and you have to, like, dig around and get... I'm talking about myself a little bit. It's like, I don't buy... I'm not an extravagant buyer, but still, more than a few pairs, it makes too much in the bottom of my closet. I don't know about others, you know. So it's like these things, these choices that we make. And also, I can say for sure that the people that live in those conditions might have to find a deeper meaning in life or they would kill themselves. Mm-hmm. And they say that that's how the people survived the concentration camps. The ones that saw purpose in the suffering are the ones that survived. And the ones that saw no value in it did not survive. So it's like this little story. Why, you know, the child gets the toy, but I don't like this toy. I want that toy. Or why did Dad give me this and not that one? So it's all of these things which also have to do with judgments. And ultimately, judgment confines the mind. It confines the heart. And when we open that cage, then there's just space. And there's love in that. And that's the Sufi way also. Yes.
Roger, would you like to go ahead and turn on your mic? He asked me to read it for him. May pain flower into strength. May shame develop into mercy. May illness transform into compassion. May anger dissolve into divine stillness.
Thank you. So this is... Oh, is there more?
These are the thoughts that have been in my mind stream the past few weeks. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, you will like this, Roger. This, and you may be familiar with it from your Buddhist training, this is called the causal law in terms of happiness. It really has to do with the 12 links of dependent origination. Those are the few that have studied it. The Buddha says, suffering leads to confidence. Suffering leads to confidence. Confidence leads to rapture. Rapture leads to joy. Joy to tranquility. Tranquility to happiness. Happiness to concentration. Now it turns. Concentration to the knowledge and vision of things as they truly are. As they truly are, not what we project on them, not what we assign them, not what we want them to be, but what they truly are. The knowledge and vision of things as they truly are to repulsion. Repulsion meaning, I've often, you know, I have a lot of friends that are monks and nuns and in that monastic tradition, as many others, they're celibate. But some of the people are so beautiful. I mean, you know, you just feel this energy about them. I mean, partly it's because they're monastics, they've contained that energy, and they're just really vital, you know. And they have a sensuality about them, too, just naturally. So I say to them, well, how do you deal with this celibacy thing? This is one of the ways. To the knowledge and vision of things as they truly are. They said, because when we look at something, we know that it is only a momentary feeling that might arise. And it's an attachment. But if we analyze it further, then we understand that, like, even our bodies, what are our bodies? They have an appearance of something. But it really just a collection of bone and skin and pus and blood, and when the breath leaves it, like Murshid said, then it's good for nothing. Who wants to go around a dead body, even if they loved it more than anything in the world? And all you have to do is look very far. You know, they have this built-in obsolescence in everything we buy. You get a new car, you're in love with it. You want it. Most of the time, you want to take people for a ride in your new car, and you just want to share that experience. And then all of a sudden it gets a ding or a dang or a rust or a this, and then pretty soon, well, we don't want that car anymore. It's not as beautiful as we thought. It's old, it's passé, and we want another one. Or people. Some people are like that with relationships. Oh, it's so exciting, it's fun, I'm getting to know them, we're doing fun things, and then pretty soon it changes. It matures is what it does, but people like the fascination of new love, so then they go seek something else. So here it goes like this. But if you see the knowledge and vision of things as they truly are, then we see it also in ourselves. It's only a moment. And the knowledge and vision of things as they truly are to repulsion. Repulsion to non-attachment. Non-attachment to deliverance. Deliverance to the extinction of passions. And it says, this is an important passage that clearly indicates how suffering can lead to happiness and ultimately to sainthood. There were a lot of years I spent time with Mersha. When they first developed the searchable database that was on a disk, you know, that was one of the things I really wanted to know. Everything that he said about pain and suffering. And I think it's a worthy search, because those are the things that teach us the most. We don't need to seek them. As I said, we don't need to attack. We don't need to reach out. It will come. It comes. It's like everything comes. And when it comes, this is the purpose of practice. We're prepared. Perhaps we're prepared. And in that teaching, The Art of War, they always say that. Don't exhaust yourself chasing the enemy. By the time you reach it, you'll be too tired to do the battle, for God's sake. Let the enemy wear themselves out coming to you. It's true, though. Think about it. I mean, and you know, in my opinion, one of our great presidents studied that and used that method. Kennedy did. He was very keen on that. So these are the kinds of things like, I'm going to do this. No. Let it be. If it's yours to do, you'll know. Otherwise, let it go. Yes.
Roger does.
Oh, Raheem has a question.
Yes, Raheem. Raheem, you had a question?
Oh, he wants me to read it. How is Sufi fauna related to Buddhist extinction?
I think they're slightly different aspects of a teaching, but fauna is the annihilation of the self. Dissolving the self there are different stages. First, it is in the manner of the teacher, and then it is in the manner of the peer, Rasul, Nabi and Rasul, you would say, the teacher, the prophet, the messenger, ultimately leading to the dissolution of self in God. Did I answer your question? Everyone's aware of those teachings, yes? Sufis in the room. Leading to fana. Fana meaning annihilation, and baka meaning resurrection. Or recreation, you might say.
In response to if that answers the question, he said, for me, it's a beginning.
Yeah. Well, it's always a beginning. Beginner's mind is the best.
Thank you.
You're welcome. One of the things that Mersha talks about, Hazard Nai Khan, he says, one of the other statements that's coming to mind when doing this research for the talk at summer school is, he says, all tragedy and misery in life comes from our lack of penetration. And our lack of penetration creates lack of understanding. And in this world, we expect that the world will give us understanding, but we ourselves must search for that understanding. And then he goes on to say in a different place, how do we gain this understanding? And how do you develop penetration, so to speak? And he gives an answer. One's through curiosity, not through thinking we know everything, but through curiosity, by asking questions, by being open. And the other one is through a concentrated effort to go deeply into something, to understand it better. It's really, but all tragedy and misery comes from lack of penetration. You know, being able to penetrate into the deeper meaning of something. There's no other aim worth attaining than God. Other objects may seem valuable for a moment, but in reality, no object is of value save God. To realize God, to reach God, and to be blessed. But in order to practice ourselves, we may set some object before us and keep it before us by breath. We have attained it. So these are these practices, and some of you may have received those practices where you're asked to concentrate on an object and just keep your gaze very steady until such time you analyze everything about the object, and then you bring the object into your own mind and concentration, and then you change the object creatively in your mind. You may change color or shape or change its angle. Then you project the object at a distance and see it someplace else. Then you bring it back. Then you dissolve it. A very elaborate practice, but nothing too extremely esoteric. They're good practices to help one be able to hold something in the mind. And what also does it teach? It teaches from a mystical point of view the ability. And again, this isn't like magic carpet stuff. This is, if I have a friend who's very sick and I want to help, I'm not going to help by going around and patting them on their back and, are you okay? That doesn't help anybody. It makes them feel pathetic. But if you can, without any pomp and circumstance, you learn how to do these practices and project and hold an object at a concentration at a distance, you can offer your prayer. You can offer a vibration that's soothing in some way and helpful. Do you understand? There's a reason for that. But I would also say that one must also ask gently inwardly, is the person ready to receive it? So as to not impose our will on that person. Because like the toys, we don't know. They may be getting just what they need to develop in some way. It's not ours to take away from them, but if we can offer something, then we can do that. And this is why we learn these practices, so that we can, you know, this is what this does. Earlier today, you would not believe, maybe 10 minutes before, and some of you heard it, didn't you? I went to the window and I just did that. I just sent the prayer to those children. It was very loud. Thought we're going to have to really concentrate. I thought, I'm just going to send the breath there, that they're going to decide it's going to be cooler and better for them to move on. And they did. Actually, they first sat out there all by themselves and got very quiet. Did you notice? This is how you can do it, because I knew it would be very disturbing to the class. And I just thought, wouldn't it be nice for you to have something cool to drink and maybe go inside? And, you know what I mean? And there they just collected in the shade first, and I think they're gone. They must have gone inside. But, you know, it was just something to give them to think about.
And all the books have been quiet to me.
Yeah. Yeah. So it can have its effect. You know, it works a lot with crying babies on planes. Sitting next to me, though. I don't want to be tested again.
It reminded me of a previous trip.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but in order to practice ourselves, we may set an object before us and keep it before us until by the breath we have attained it. We must keep our mind fixed towards one point, as the needle on the compass is to turn to one point. The difficulty is keeping the one object of our desire before us. When we are attaining to this or aiming this to this, another illumination calls from here, another intellect from there, another wisdom from a fourth side. If we turn to these, the objects before us may remain as an imagination, but in reality are gone. By concentrating on the breath, a person can tell what element is passing through them at the moment. And by consulting the breath, he can tell the present and the future. It's very interesting teaching. It's perhaps too esoteric to even talk about. But you see, he's now giving now you know why I keep hounding on these elemental breaths too. You know, it's like, why? We can know what element we're in. Are we in the fire? Are we in the water? Are we in the air? The etheric? How can we balance that? And if we're, and we have, I've known people like this. You can tell that their two predominant elements are air and fire. And the air is stoking that fire, and they're just like, you know, this. And they can't concentrate on anything. And they are so brilliant, but they absolutely fail at everything because they're not able to keep their concentration on anything. They're too, they've diversified so much that they're just like this, you know, and they're just everywhere. And you can see that it's absolutely those two elements have come into conjunction and they're out of control, like a fire is when it gets too much wind going with it. And what they need the most and which they resist the most is the discipline that Earth can give them. They really don't like that. They don't want to be contained. They want to be that way, and yet they're always complaining that they're failing. So these are how these things work.